Hello and welcome to Stepping Into Truth, the podcast where we take on the issues of race, gender, and social justice. I'm your host, Omkari Williams, and I'm very glad you're here with me today. I love doing this podcast. I'm privileged to speak with people who are out in the world making a difference with their day jobs, their programs, their art, their activism. If you would like to support me in doing this work, you can do so for as little as $3 a month by becoming a member of my Patreon community. You can go to patreon.com/OmkariWilliams and sign up. There's also a link on my website, OmkariWilliams.com. This interview is being recorded in October of 2020, just a few weeks ahead of the presidential election and still in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. Both of those events have made it abundantly clear that there are two Americas. Communities of color have been disproportionately impacted by COVID-19, and the conversation about race has become prominent in recent months in the wake of increased awareness of police violence against the Black community. The impact of both these things is profound on groups of people already experiencing the effects of trauma. My guest today is someone who engages with trauma as a core part of her work, and, in particular, looks at the broader impacts of our systems on marginalized groups of people. Stacey K. Haynes is the author of the newly released book, The Politics of Trauma: Somatics, Healing, and Social Justice. Haynes's book explores the connections between personal and social transformation. She is the co-founder of Generative Somatics, a multiracial social justice organization bringing somatics to social and climate justice movements. She has been teaching and coaching in the field of somatics for the last 25 years. And it is my great pleasure to have Stacey K. Haynes on the podcast. Hi, Stacey. How are you?
Hi, great to be with you.
Thank you. I'm so happy that you're here with me today. So because we don't have a ton of time and your book is deep and multi-layered, I really want to focus on just one area of what you write about, and that is systemic trauma as it applies to race and the movement for racial justice. Now, having said that, I want the listeners to know that there is way more to this book than this subject, and I really highly recommend this book to anyone dealing with trauma of any sort. So to start, what I'd like to do is get a definition of terms, because not everyone may be familiar with what the term somatic means. Tell us what that means.
Thank you. Yes, somatics is really a different way of understanding both kind of how we're shaped and also how we change. That goes from a holistic approach. So it really considers kind of our thinking, our emotions, how we act, how we relate as one whole integrated system. So when we look at changing, it's not just changing our thoughts, it's really changing what we've embodied over time so that our changes or our transformation can actually show up in how we act and how we relate.
Okay. That's very helpful, because I think that one of the things that we often do is we kind of fragment ourselves into different pieces, and we'll work on one piece of ourselves and leave the rest out. And ultimately, I don't believe that works as well as we hope for it to work. So somatics feels like a more integrated approach to that whole idea of addressing whatever issue is coming up. Is that an accurate restatement?
Yeah, absolutely. Also, you know, a lot of our survival strategies, I mean, when we start talking about systemic trauma, this will make sense, but a lot of our survival strategies are automatic and become unconscious. And so we're like dealing with all these symptoms of having been hurt or of systemic trauma and not having access about how to transform them or how to become more whole or more empowered again. And somatics really helps us understand how to do that in a more holistic way. So I trust we'll dive in more.
But absolutely. Yes. Yeah, great. We absolutely will. Okay, so now that we've got that sorted, I really want to move on to what feels like the crux of the issue to me. And I'm going to start in a way that may sort of feel backwards, but I think it's going to work. You talk a lot in this book about power over structures. Mm-hmm. And the phrase power over is fairly self-explanatory. But again, just so we're on the same page, all of us, would you talk about what you mean by that and where power over structures shows up in U.S. society?
Everywhere.
A few places. Pick a few.
Yeah, power over is basically the assumption that some peoples, some genders, some races are inherently better than and more deserved of than others. So it's a domination-based set of beliefs, ways we learn to relate, ways we learn to think about God, the land, each other, resources that really concentrate worth. We'll talk about this more, but concentrate safety, belonging, dignity, and resources into very, very few people. And that power over is predictable. It is structured along the lines of white supremacy and racism. So white people are considered better. It's structured along the lines of gender. So that really cisgendered males, along sexuality, along class, right? So it's very predictable lines of domination, and really everything gets structured along those lines, from how our school systems work, to media, to who gets access to resources, or how capitalism works, like that.
Okay, so given that there is no place that does not impact us, these power over structures, it seems like it would be a really challenging thing to even begin to discern how you take those apart. And you, in your book, reference a famous Audre Lorde quote, and it's the one, "For the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house." And many people are familiar with that quote, but I don't think that as many people recognize that Lorde went on to say, "They," referring to the master's tools, "may allow us to temporarily beat him at his own game, but they will never enable us to bring about genuine change." And to me, that last part is really critical, especially as it relates to social justice movements like Black Lives Matter or climate change movements and these power over strategies. So could you walk us through how these power over strategies manifest in, just pick one area of our thinking, and how we need to really shift that dynamic in order to move towards a more just society?
Yeah, well, thank you for bringing up Audre Lorde. I have learned so much from her writings and got the opportunity in the 90s to meet her before she passed. I just really hold her as a teacher and a guide for many. You know, a lot of what I focus on in the book is really looking at how is personal transformation and systemic transformation connected. And one of the things we look at in somatics is that we end up embodying things that we actually don't believe in or that aren't our values. And so even those of us who have a deep set of values for justice, for equity, for sustainability of the planet, still really get shaped by and embody power over ideas, ways of relating, of course, ways of surviving that power over when you're in a group that's targeted and oppressed. So this connection, really what we're looking at is, how do we transform to be more and more whole and more aligned with our values, so that the visions and the strategies we come up with for how we want society to transform are really more aligned with those values. So, you know, one of the things we talk about is personal transformation. To really transform deeply personally, we definitely need support and a group and a community of practice. And let's say we could do that with like 12 people, a small number, right? But when we look at really transforming systemically, we need movements. So the bigger the system is, the more people we need to transform that system. And like you said, it isn't about reform. You know, something that I love so much that's coming out of the movement for Black Lives is this whole call to defund the police, not to reform the police, but to actually transform how we think about justice, how we think about transforming poverty. How many people are imprisoned for survival crimes due to poverty and oppression? To really uproot and transform how we see the whole system and keep moving toward economic equity, to transform conflict and even violence using community-based or transformative justice models. So it is this like growing our own capacity to vision equitable systems while we then get better and better at organizing, right, as masses of people and movements to really call for that vision and then practice and learn our way into that vision. Does that make sense?
It does. It makes perfect sense. What I'm hearing you say is that we need to change ourselves in order to change society, and we need to change the structures of society in order to change ourselves at scale, that they sort of work in concert. Is that accurate? Or
was so beautifully said. That's exactly it. You know, I think a lot about, like, in public health, they talk about primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've always been an activist, and my deep kind of training and calling has really been about, let's say, healing work. But I couldn't, like, why I never became, let's say, a healer or a therapist only, is because that is prevention work or healing work that is way down the line from the source of the harm or the source of the trauma. And, you know, really when I look at systemic trauma and particularly the trauma caused by white supremacy and through racism, the source of the trauma are unjust systems of white supremacy. That's the root cause of the trauma. So we could do personal healing all day long around transforming the impacts of racism, right? Or white people really transforming how we've been shaped by white privilege. But that won't change the root cause, right, of all those traumas unless we uproot white supremacy and really change the systems, the structures, and the social narratives that keep, you know, forwarding this kind of domination model. Yeah, and do so much harm. Systemic oppression causes trauma in millions of people, right? That's why it's so important to do social change work tied to personal transformation work so we can really uproot those the root causes of the harm.
So what I'm hearing you say is, you know, obviously there is personal trauma. People have personal things that happen to them as individuals in their lives that negatively impact them, that they are then, if they're fortunate enough to have the resources of all sorts, financial, emotional, familial resources, if they're fortunate enough to have those, that they can then try and confront them. But that the systemic trauma is sometimes a separate issue, sometimes part of the same issue, but is almost inevitably layered upon whatever personal trauma we have. So we're dealing with both things potentially at the same time. And while we can do all of that personal work, if we don't address the systemic issues, it ultimately isn't going to be, I'm not going to say it doesn't matter, but it's not going to be as fruitful as if we address the systemic issues as well.
That's right. Yeah, I appreciate you frame things very, very well. So let me give a couple of examples. So I was sexually abused as a kid. And one could say that's a very deeply, deeply, obviously personal experience of trauma. And if I kind of scale out, that is to me one of the tools of oppression. It's like it trains us into, like, child abuse, child sexual abuse trains us into that domination model so young and so vulnerably. And I also look, it's like, okay, so, you know, me and my sisters all got sexually abused. That was also really an expression of patriarchy, right? And sexism and a deep training into that system. So while child sexual abuse was a very deeply personal experience for me, it was also a form of systemic, right, trauma
yes.
that I was experiencing. So it's really the both and. And I think for many forms of trauma, it's also interconnected. There's a both and. It's like poverty is traumatizing. Poverty is a systemic issue. And then I want to flip this over and say one thing about different healing modalities, because there's so many really potent healing modalities. And sadly, there's a lot of mainstream healing modalities that don't actually integrate an understanding of oppression and liberation. And so there can be healing modalities that inadvertently keep supporting systemic oppression, even when they're trying to do individual healing. And, you know, when we look at, you know, mainstream Western frames of one-on-one therapy that don't have a social analysis, again, inadvertently, those can reinforce, like, remember when people used to talk about like shopping therapy?
Yes.
And I'm like, oh, no, that is a contradiction in terms.
Yes. Right?
So you get what I'm saying.
I totally do. So that's very interesting to me, because I think that one of the things that I've observed over the years, having, you know, done so much of the let me work on myself stuff and all of the things that people do,
yeah,
is that there is a way in which it actually is undermining, because what it supports is the notion that this is all about me and
right.
And problems with me, and that it doesn't really include the problems that are outside of me. I mean, not to say I don't have problems. Of course I do. But right. there are problems that are outside of me that have impacted me throughout my whole life, that sort of pull yourself up by your own bootstraps thinking does not really address, and actually it makes it worse, because you feel like, well, I'm failing at fixing whatever yeah, it is.
Exactly. I mean, there's a deep individualism built into a lot of models of healing and therapy in many Western contexts, right? Not in the history of healing. If we look at human history writ large, healing has been seen as a collective process. And I'm really hoping in healing justice work, or in how much social change movements are really starting to integrate more trauma healing approaches, I really hope that there's more and more access to collective healing. But the individualism of kind of, let's say, straight up mainstream therapy can be then disempowering, either self-blaming, like, well, why can't I get over this? When it's like, how do you get over white supremacy and racism? We have to change.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or it doesn't inspire us into collective action. And I think one thing that we forget is collective action can be so transformative and healing in and of itself. Like when we come together and say, we share a vision toward equity, we share a vision toward transforming society to justice and reconnecting ourselves to the planet, that collective action or that collective visioning is so healing in and of itself as a part of our individual healing.
I think that we've seen that manifest this past few months when we saw the hundreds of thousands of people who marched in condemnation of what happened to George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Elijah McClain, and the list goes on. And the diversity of those groups, and just even if you were watching on television, the power that I experienced watching those people, that just was really remarkable to me, to just see that many people of such diverse ethnicities and ages and experiences and socioeconomic levels all coming together and saying, no, this is not okay with us. This is not who we want to be going forward. We need to fix this. Was really impactful and gave me hope that maybe we're turning a corner. And I'm wondering what your experience was.
I mean, very similar, inspiring, motivating, mobilizing, healing, enraging, right?
Yeah.
But I also want to remind us, it's like anger is also a part of healing, right? Anger is a part of reclaiming dignity. I actually think that's one of its core roles, is it helps us reclaim dignity and reclaim boundaries. So there's, you know, obviously a wide range of emotions go along with healing, but very, very inspiring. And then, you know, I think a lot about, obviously there's a lot coming up in this election, but really the mobilization and how many different types of people are mobilized toward justice gets to continue no matter who wins on November 3rd or December 3rd or whenever all the ballots come in.
Right.
Right. But that mobilization is really about, it's like a call for healing, a call for justice and equity, and really a call for collective transformation. And all of those things are so life affirming. You know, I really feel like deep inside of our, you know, somatics would say deep inside of our soma, or deep inside of our mind, body, spirit, is a real yearning toward life, right? And toward healing and toward justice. It's one of the reasons I've stayed in somatics so long, because I really notice as people get access to coming deeply back into their own aliveness or into our own skins, that there's something inherent in us that really does want to heal, transform, and move toward life, move toward interdependence. And I think healing helps us access that more deeply, and also being a part of, you know, movements together for life and justice help us access that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. And something you said just now reminded me of part of the definition of somatics that I highlighted when I was reading your book, was that it includes a sense of belonging and an experience of dignity as things that we actually need in order to be healthy in the world. And that really struck me because I have never heard it put that way. I've never heard belonging and dignity just framed as essential pieces of our emotional and mental health.
Yeah.
And that struck me really powerfully.
It's one of the things that I really love in the somatic approach too, is it really looks at there are automatic ways that we adapt to what are inherent needs. And somatics really considers three things: safety, belonging, and dignity as inherent needs for all human beings. And we have this big evolutionary history, and it's deep in our biologies, right? Deep in our mind, body, spirit, that we'll adapt to find safety, we'll adapt to belong, and we'll adapt to find dignity. And one of the things that's so destructive about trauma is that it breaks our experience and betrays our ability to access safety, belonging, and dignity. So when we look at white supremacy or we look at systemic racism, it basically is telling masses of groups of human beings that they don't belong, and masses of groups of human beings that they're not inherently dignified and that they're not permitted safety. Right? Like all these police killings are a systemic expression of anti-Black racism that's saying you don't deserve safety, right? That's why, or it's one way to understand how traumatizing racism is, because it breaks safety, belonging, and dignity en masse that way.
I completely agree. And I have to say, I hadn't thought of it in those terms before I read your book. But once I did, it was so obvious. It was like, well, of course that's true. And something else you say in the book, and I'd love for you to talk about, is you specifically talk about how colonization impacts these needed experiences. Yeah. And if you could speak about that, I would really love that.
Oh God, it's just so heartbreaking. I think I'm just connected for a moment with the pain, you know, just the unnecessary pain caused by all of this. So yeah, when we look at colonization, I think one thing that's so, can be so hard to face, and I think there's a whole bunch of white people in the United States that are newly facing or more deeply facing the legacy of colonization, the legacy of slavery and white supremacy in the US. And it's so, so important because there's this process also of white people feeling deeply and white people mobilizing other white people toward equity, right? And following, of course, the lead of people of color. But in colonization, it was so systematically designed. That's what's so painful, is it was really uprooting people from thousands of years of relationship to land. It was literally unbelonging, right, indigenous people.
Yes.
From land, from identity, from language, from each other. And then when, and I know you know this history, but when indigenous people and enslaved Africans started organizing together, and even when some Europeans who were brought as indentured servants started organizing together, that was the moment in US history that the idea of whiteness was created. It was really to break alliances between indigenous, African, and European indentured servants, and to basically give those European indentured servants access to wealth and whiteness if they played along, right, with the oppression. But the multi-generational trauma of that breaking relationship with land, with language, with culture, is still being healed in indigenous communities today.
Yes. I mean, it is one of the most painful parts of American history for me, is that experience of just such disruption and with such intent. I mean, this was not an accident. This was intentional. And that's hard to wrap your mind around. And it's hard to even begin to see how we undo the damage that that has done. I don't know that that's possible. And that's tragic.
Yeah. I think one of the things that just blows me away, and maybe one of the places I do keep getting hope, is the level of continuity, both of many indigenous cultures and many, you know, when I think about like the, also the very literal uprooting of people who were brought here enslaved, the uprooting from land, culture, belonging, and yet this deep, deep continuity. And it's one of the places that I really look and go, wow, that continuity, there's something so powerful, whether we call it in spirit, in culture, in the capacity to heal, but just the sheer survival and then thriving of so many peoples who have been so profoundly oppressed. There's something in that that is profound and beautiful and so deeply worth listening to and learning from.
Yes, it is so true. My friends who are Native American, I watch what they do in their communities, and it's so beautiful and it's incredible. And I always feel uplifted because I think, wow, you know, you got shoved onto a corner of bad land and still have persisted in the same way that African Americans have still persisted. And this gives me hope and just makes me feel like fundamentally there is a grit to Black and Indigenous people in this country that will not allow for this to continue indefinitely. And as I said before, hopefully we're at a turning point.
Yeah, may that be so. Really, may that be so.
Well, another thing that you said that I found really interesting was about the impact of power over systems on those with systemic privilege. And I don't think we think about that very often, but it's really important. So I want you to tell us about how you have witnessed that and what you think that means for society at large.
Yeah. So this feels important to unpack in a really like grounded way, because the shaping, and sorry to use that word, it's a somatic word, but it's like how we're shaped by and how we embody systems of oppression, of course, are different. We're impacted differently depending on our social location. So since we're looking at really the systemic trauma of racism, if we look at white folks, there's a way that that shaping is about misunderstanding that our sense of safety, belonging, and dignity is based on power over. So it's like white people, I'm generalizing, but I'm talking about the shaping, is to separate or individualize or feel threatened, like safety's threatened when it's not concretely or pragmatically or materially threatened, because other peoples are becoming more empowered. So it's like this profound embodied misunderstanding that separation or domination begets more safety, or separation or domination begets more worth. So it's like this profound embodiment of a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think part of, you know, the collective work, let's say, of people of European descent in the United States or white folks, is this profound transformation to understand that interdependence is safety, that equity brings belonging, that it's the we in a much more profound way that makes us more whole as human beings. It's a reconnection with the land and a respect with the land that makes us more whole, rather than this idea of success and the singular leader, like all the individualized power over ways we're trained to think of success or think of making it or think of like, now my family is safe. It's like embodying a lie that hurts other people and then also hurts us and our communities.
This is really tricky, because that whole idea of individual power, of individual worth, of the individual as sort of the ultimate in some ways rather than the communal, has become so deeply ingrained in how we think about things. We're always competing to be higher up on the hierarchical ladder of things. And that's all about the individual and not about communal. So I completely understand what you're saying, and I agree. I just wonder how we get there, you know?
Yeah, that's great. That's great. So you know what's also so interesting is all those things are true, and then people are so lonely.
Yeah.
And I think about that loneliness, and that is something deep inside of us calling for interdependence, like knowing something at a more profound level, or else everybody like rich, separated, and individualized would be super happy, but that's not what's happening. So when I look at how do we change this, I think that's why I just keep coming back to this pulse or this rhythm or this interconnection between becoming more whole, more healed, more, I even want to say more fully human as individuals, right? So cultivating our own healing, being in practices that are about becoming more whole, not just about becoming more dominating, rich, or successful, but about becoming more whole while we simultaneously connect ourselves to broader collective movements for change. And we can all do this. I mean, this is something I really appreciate about you, when you're like, find the style of activist you are, find your right place or your one or two issues, right? So it's, we want to be ourselves and then bring our full selves into a broader collective that's working toward a vision of equity and connection to the planet. So I just think it's this rhythm of both and. And it's like what you said beautifully in the beginning. It's like all that individual healing helps us become better inside of social change work, and all the social change helps us become more whole as humans. But I really do think that wholing of ourselves, that coming more deeply back into ourselves, literally leads to more interdependence with others. That collective action keeps inspiring us to heal. So I just think there's like this double beat or rhythm where they serve each other.
Yeah, that's lovely. I could feel my body kind of go, as I sort of settled into that vision of engaging with people in that way, which is actually part of what's so difficult right now is the pandemic has made us isolated in ways that we are unaccustomed to being. And I mean, I'm an introvert and I find it frustrating and isolating. I can only imagine what people who are extroverts are experiencing and trying to find our way to keep doing communal things in a setting that is not communal, if you're using your head, feels very challenging. And, you know, I just hope we get our heads and our hands around this soon so that we can figure out how to move forward in doing the things we need to do without putting ourselves and others at risk. And I think that's a challenge right now.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, I'm more introverted as I age, but really I'm an extrovert. And I cannot tell you how much I miss hugging people, touching people, just being with them or being in practice together, body to body. And, you know, for those of us who can access Zoom or, you know, access podcasts, there is a lot happening online that even if we just go, okay, let me plug into two things per week, there are different programs, courses, practices happening that are based in somatics, based in even collective practice that are about healing in this time. And then there's a lot of things online that are about how do we engage with each other towards social change. And that's anything from like the various things that Movement for Black Lives are doing that any of us can join, or Surge showing up for racial justice, which is really giving white people a place to organize and kind of wake up and become, you know, do the work toward ending white supremacy. You know, environmental justice or climate justice organizations are doing gatherings. So I've often thought, or in talking with people, like, if we can invest in one healing thing and one social justice thing per week, a lot of that is now accessible. And then we get to see folks from all over. That does not replace getting together in person, but it's something while we figure out this pandemic, huh?
Yeah. And you actually, my next and last question was going to be, what are three simple actions that listeners can take to start to address trauma systemically or personally, and also just to be able to make progress in the direction of social justice, given the circumstances in which we're living? So you've already given us a couple. Is there anything else you would like to add to that?
Yeah, I'm going to do the social justice one first and then talk about a personal practice. So to join an organization that is supporting social transformation. And we can join literally by just signing up our names. It could be, again, Movement for Black Lives. It could be Surge. It could be the Working Families Party. There's just amazing stuff happening online right now. With a little bit of research, folks can find what resonates for them and join. And it's both just joining by signing up. It could be joining by joining Zoom calls or meetings. It could even be going, great, I'm going to do some phone banking between now and the election, right? And also planning really with your people, what are you planning to do from election to January 21st, right, to inauguration? There's a lot of great stuff out there to help us understand what are some of the best actions we can take. Let me just give one resource, which is pretty easy to find online, and I can send it to you too, but it's an online guide called Hold the Line, a guide to defending democracy. There's an amazing amount of kind of how to and what to do there. Then on the very personal side, I really want to invite people to be in a daily resilience building practice. We are collectively dealing with so much stress right now.
Oh, yeah.
So much stress. I don't think in my lifetime I have seen us in this level of collective stress. So there's a pretty simple somatic resilience practice, which is to really go back to a time in your life where you had an experience where you felt resourced, you felt more whole, you felt more connected to yourself or more connected to life. And we all access that in different ways. For some of us, it's really being with people that we love. For some of us, it's music and dance. For some of us, it's nature and connecting to nature or animals, right? So going back to a particular experience, really put yourself back in that experience and recall what it felt like to be there. And really access in your felt senses, in your body, your emotions, your feeling self, what was that like? Did my heart open more? Did I feel calmer and more settled? Did I warm up? But go back and access that experience and just let your whole nervous system recall it and feel it. And then when you can, if you can do even a 10-minute daily practice where you purposely find yourself to something that brings you resilience. So for me, that might be literally staring up at a tree. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a very small town in Colorado, and boy, do pine trees give me a lot of resilience, right? For other people, it might be like that song, just play that song and then let it really inform your nervous system. So we keep resourcing ourselves every day with a little bit of resilience. It just helps us be able to navigate through these stressful times a little bit better.
That sounds lovely. And yeah, there are definitely those moments that all of us have had. And I think too often we let them just sort of live in the past, but living into them now is definitely going to be helpful. So thank you so much for those suggestions. They're wonderful. Stacy, I have enjoyed this conversation so much. I really can't thank you enough, especially after the last 4 years, not to mention the past 8 months. Trauma is such a very present subject for us. And this conversation has made me feel that healing and progress are truly possible. And thank you so much for speaking with me. And thank you for all the work that you're doing. I really appreciate it.
You're so welcome. And I'm honored. Just thank you for our conversation. And thank you for what you're contributing out into the world. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And to all of you listening, if this conversation has resonated for you, I highly recommend that you get yourself a copy of Stacy's book, The Politics of Trauma. It really is an important read. By the time this episode airs, we will be right up against Election Day, and what the next 4 years will look like is going to be dramatically different depending on the outcome. Regardless of who wins, there's going to be a lot of healing to do. At its core, social justice is about healing. So let's commit to doing that work for ourselves and for our society. Thank you all so much for listening. I will be back with another episode of Stepping into Truth very soon. Until then, remember, change starts with story. So keep sharing yours.